Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're all very welcome back. Now, deciding which career path to pursue, it often can be a real arbitrary process. But for some people, their passion becomes their day job. Lucky them. A lovely article in the Irish Examiner earlier this week introduced us to three people who've done just this. Sarah Kem Watchorn is a food stylist from Wexford, and she is right across from me in the studio here now. I'm also joined on the line, by Louise Griffey, who is a pet grief recovery specialist. She's in Cork, and Donal Mulcahy is a taxidermist from Limerick. Welcome to you all. Very different jobs. We'll start with you, Sarah Kem. You are a food stylist. Tell people listening what that actually is.
Quite an unusual career. Basically, it's making food look good for camera. I guess it's like being an artist of food, putting it on a plate. Yeah.
So it's dressing food, isn't it?
Dressing food on plates, dressing sets. It goes from, like, my job is not just like putting food on plates. It's writing recipes, food articles, developing recipes.
Okay, yeah, so everything food related. Yeah. So how did you get into this? What did you study?
I have a degree in culinary arts, so that's kind of how it all started. I'm a horse girl, so my farrier's sister was a food stylist, and he was like, just go on a work experience with her, see what it's like. At the time, I had no idea, and yeah, I eventually went on work experience with her and absolutely loved it.
Do you know what's amazing? Because probably if we went back 20 years, your job wouldn't even have existed. Or if it did, there weren't many of you.
Yeah, there's still very few nowadays, but I think people have more awareness of the job because of social media and stuff like that. Yeah.
And actually on that point, you know, I love Instagram. You probably love it too, being in the business you're in, because it's such a visual feast, really. And I find that, you know, you're selling to people as well when you're looking at something visually, because we eat with our eyes. We often hear that. So, I mean, I could put food on the plate now. I could say cook fish or whatever, and I'd just be thrown there. Whereas you would come along and dress it up. What would you do now? So let's just, I'm taking a piece of salmon. Boom. Okay. I'm testing you. I'm taking a piece of salmon and I've got like my lovely new potatoes from my garden.
Yeah.
And I just put them on the plate. What would you do?
To me, it's about composition. So how like one element might balance the other, different textures, different shapes, different like features like that. I also love like the little bits that a lot of people like don't necessarily notice, but know that it's a good shot because it's there. So maybe I'd have three potatoes instead of someone might add four. I'd add like salt and pepper to garnish and some like small, gorgeous little leaves, things like that.
Okay. And what about the way you cut vegetables? Because if I was cutting a carrot, I just chop it regularly. But I noticed because I present the Today Show on RT. So we have a lot of food as part of our show every single day. And, you know, presentation is everything. Mm-hmm. And I've become a bit chefy. That is the word, isn't it? Myself. And some of the big chefs that we have on the show that were regulars and very well-known chefs have often said to me, oh, that's very chefy, that thing you put up on Insta the other night. So cutting carrots into like batons, is that the way you do it, I suppose? To chopping them roughly like I would do.
Yeah, and I love to keep like their natural shape as well. So maybe keep a little bit of the green that's on the top of a baby carrot, or keep their natural shape that you know what you're eating, you know, especially because we have such good produce here in Ireland too.
So you work, as you said, with restaurants, you work with chefs. So working with a chef, what would you do? I know you worked with Donal Skehan, who is just a fabulous guy. I love Donal. He's such great crack.
Love doing his shows over the years. And then, yeah, with chefs,
with Donal, tell us what you did with him.
I worked with him on, I styled his TV shows and his cookbook. His second last one, I think it was. He's so many at this point. I would work with him on figuring out what style he'd like to use for the cookbook. His TV shows, it's everything from organising the recipes, what day we're shooting them, what ingredients need to be got, where I need to get them. Yeah.
Okay, it's interesting. I was watching his TV show the other night, last week, I think. And, you know, it's beautifully shot first because, you know, it's the family home kind of setting and all that. And the background is kind of blurred. But what I was doing, like we all did very kind of voyeuristically, I was looking, as he was in his kitchen, I was looking to the background of what was behind, okay? So I guess you have to think of all that, do you?
Yeah, I know now they have like a set dresser, but when I was one of the years that I was doing the show, I style the set as well, which is something that I really love. I love like all the little elements that go into it. Like if you were to get like fresh flowers for the table or little gorgeous jars for salt and pepper and the small details like that, I think are really important. And obviously other people notice them as well.
Have you noticed over the last number of years with social media and all that, that if food isn't presented in a sexy way, for want of a better word, that people might want to go and eat in a different restaurant or maybe, you know, if shops, because I know you work with Super Value as well, or you have.
Yes. I think the imagery of food is so important. And I also think it showcases like the quality of what a business is sending out or producing, you know. If they can back it with like gorgeous imagery or videos, it definitely shows.
How did you know that you had the talent for this? I mean, how did you feel that this was your calling?
Oh God, I wasn't great at it when I started. Something just clicked with me at some point in my career. I did a food style, a little bit of training with girls in London. And then I also like gained more confidence in like myself. Okay. And I think that really brought out like better like Sarah Kim as a food stylist.
Right, so it was over time you developed it. Yeah. And what about the recipe testing? Tell me about what that is.
So basically, a client might come to me with ingredients or a product or whatever, and I need to come up with a recipe or a concept around that. So whether they come to me with like potatoes and I come up with 5 ideas for like potato cake or like fritters or different things, and then they choose what they want and I develop a recipe around that.
That's really interesting, isn't it? What do you guys think out there listening this morning? 51551, do you eat with your eyes? Would you want to make a recipe because it looks good visually as well of how it tastes? And you work as well, as you said, you help chefs develop that recipe, but they kind of tell you that they might want to do something on, as you said, potato cakes, and then you'll work it up with them. But it's funny, would they not kind of come up with the recipes themselves?
They do to a certain degree, but then I'll go through the testing process.
Yeah.
So I'll basically take the recipe apart, see how long it takes to cook it, how many muffins you get out of a specific quantity, weigh it all out, make sure it's exact, because whoever's buying the cookbook, the recipe works for them, you know.
And are you a good cook?
I can cook, yeah.
And did you train as a chef or anything?
Yeah, well, my degree in culinary arts led me to that, I guess. And when I was in my degree, I did work experience in restaurants and different kitchens around the country. Yeah.
Were you like a lot of the people getting in touch with us today about working in bars and restaurants? Did you have to kind of deal with awful people and, you know, did you have any bad situations?
I think it's a tough environment to work in, but it's definitely stood to me. I'm like a super organized person because of it. I'm super clean. Like I like things done a certain way, but I think it stood to me. It's definitely a tricky area to work
in. It is, but the texts are still coming in, actually, just while I have you there. Christina says, those of us who worked waiting tables and bars respect waiting staff and they learn valuable life lessons. Every young person should spend a year in the service industry, supermarkets or pubs. The best education for life, says Jerry. It's encapsulating the service industry and the food industry as well. I'm going to go to our next interview this morning, and this is Donal Mulcahy. Donal, you are you're in a very different career than Sarah Kim here in studio. You're a taxidermist. Tell us about your job.
Yeah, I'm a taxidermist. It's quite different than anyone else's career, I think. As a job, I'm preserving birds and animals, bringing them back into look like a bird that's alive, that has been. That has died, has been found dead, and that.
You know, when we, I would have, yeah, when yeah. Just talking about taxidermy and being a taxidermist, it's almost seems like a job from another era in one way, you know, because life today is very different. I mean, back in the day, you'd often see, you know, stuffed owls or birds and all that in a lot of different houses around the country, or pheasants. I remember the stuffed pheasants. But do many people or who uses taxidermists these days?
Who use taxidermists? It's coming back in a big way, because I think taxidermy is done better now than it used to be years ago. The methods weren't great. People didn't know the birds enough, didn't study them enough. But the people that come to me are usually people that will pick up these birds off the road, flying into windows. And unfortunately, birds that get poisoned, particularly owls and barren owls, that will pick up rat poison from dying mice and rats. And they come to me and they're in perfect condition, but they've died of poison. And that's what we found is a big problem.
It's very interesting.
Those are the people that come to me, yeah.
It's very interesting, your background, because I know you've had, like myself, you've, you know, a rural background, but you taught yourself how to become a taxidermist.
I did initially. Most of the beginning years in taxidermy, I completely taught myself. It was an absolute passion. And I started, I suppose, when I was about 12. I come from a very rural background in East Limerick, in a little town called Capmore. So back then, like, it was hurling, or it was nature, it was hunting and fishing. We lived off the land, a big family, but 9 children. And everything we got, we used, you know. It wouldn't be so much hunting and fishing for me anymore, because I don't need to go hunting, fishing to get the birds and animals I need to do taxidermy on, because I've been killed on the road and that. But when I was about 12, or maybe 13, my father got a pheasant stuffed, and everyone got a pheasant stuffed back then.
Yeah.
And we went to a place in Clare to collect it. I knew nothing about taxidermy. I was mad into nature. And living in a small farm in a rural background, you pick up a lot of things that are dead. And I used to absolutely fascinated the colour of the birds and that. And used to hate to see them fade away. But that day we went to a place in Clare with my father, and we walked into the taxidermist place, and he had a big studio, something like that I have now, with birds and animals everywhere. And something ignited in me. I suddenly realised I could actually preserve these beautiful things. So a passion started that I couldn't stop. So from there on, I was just trying to do taxidermy and really failing and destroying things. But I kept going. There was no Google back then, no internet, no one to go to. I did back then, mind you, ring a few taxidermists in Ireland trying to get help. Of course, I was very young and they're not going to take much heed of it.
Yeah.
Well, 13, 14-year-old. And so I got no help. But my father bought me this very ancient English book on taxidermy.
Sounds like Harry Potter. Seriously.
Yeah, and I must have read it 300 times or more. I still have it, actually. I still look back at it. It was a very old way of doing taxidermy, probably in Victorian times. But one day, maybe I was 15, I actually got a pheasant standing up. Everybody said it was fantastic. They were extremely generous to me, because it was, looking back at it, I wish I kept it. It was quite awful, but it was standing on 2 legs, and people told me it was great. So that really set me off again. Yeah. And slowly but surely, I started to get things looking a little bit better.
Is it difficult? I mean, if you are, as you said, you're preserving, you know, when a bird or an animal is dead, I mean, you don't want them to fade. But the lovely plumage of, say, when you think of pheasants and all that, how do you actually do it? What do you put inside of them? And how is it done? What's the process?
Yeah, it's hard to explain in a few minutes. But basically what you're doing with a bird, you need to get it within a day or 2 days maximum, so that it's not starting to deteriorate. But really what I'm doing is taking the skin off the body of the bird. And with birds, the feathers are attached to the skin. So it's like you're taking off their jacket. So you're left with a jacket, and the body that's left, you make an artificial, very quickly you make an artificial body, same size and measurements of the one that came out. And it's a lot of wires are used then on the neck and the legs to rebuild the muscles. And really the jacket of the bird, which you've taken off when you're left with the skin, that's put back over the new body and neck. And that's basically what it is, because there's a lot more into that to get the pose and get all the measurements right. It takes years and years to to try and imitate
it's
nature.
It's an artwork, really, when you think of it. And you know what, as you said there, Donal, you really are preserving the birds or preserving the animals and not letting them go away. And we're going to go to somebody now next, Louise Griffey. You're a pet grief recovery specialist based in Cork. And, you know, I know myself as an animal lover that I never wanted to lose my pets or them to go away when they died. I think losing a family pet is really losing a family member. Tell us about your job.
Hi, Maura. Yeah, definitely. It's extremely devastating for a lot of people. And I think it's probably one of the most unrecognised forms of grief that's in society, and particularly in Ireland. And even for myself, when I experienced it in 2019, it was just such a lonely space and very isolating place to be, I found. And I know a lot of people I speak to feel the same way as well.
Yeah, and you know, how did you take this path yourself then? I mean, did you just see the need for it yourself, or that your own grief led you to believe there were a lot of like-minded people out there like yourself?
Yeah, I think it all comes down to personal experience. Both of my dogs passed away within 24 hours of each other, and I kind of found myself looking for kind of specialised help. Of course, I went to counselling, but I just felt that I wanted something a little bit more specialised, and to speak to someone who maybe had been through it before, and I couldn't find that anywhere, and kind of led me to train with the Grief Recovery Institute in the US. And I think that I'm the only person in Ireland really offering this service, and it's needed so much, to be honest.
Well, you're certainly one of a few. I think there's a couple of people. But can I ask you as well, just about your dog, what happened to your dogs that they both passed away within 24 hours?
So it was kind of a traumatic accident, and I often kind of say that speaking about the specifics can be triggering for people listening. So it was just an accident, and it was just something that was very difficult to kind of deal with at the time. So looking for that kind of support was something that I was searching for, but thankfully found it, and then, you know, became trained and certified then to kind of help people. And it's more educational based, but kind of with a lot of therapeutic benefits. So there's lots of kind of, I help people through writing, journaling, just communication and group work and all kinds of things like that, which can be helpful.
And I know in the States, you say they're more ahead of us, really, the acceptance of things, and especially in this area. And grief really is grief. And losing a family pet can be very traumatic, not, you know, for young and old. So what do you do? Say a person contacts you, would you go to their house, or how does it work?
No, so I work completely online, because I have clients that are in the US, that are in Ireland and in different parts of the world. So I think that being able to work with people online through Zoom, through video, is really, really beneficial, because a lot of people, when they're grieving, the thought of having to get into the car, leave the house, go somewhere for a session, for an appointment, can be really overwhelming. And a lot of people, if they've experienced trauma with the experience of grief, whatever those events are, can be extremely difficult for them to even do basic daily tasks. So people can just be in the comfort of their own home, which is really, really good for them as well. And they can join a group online, or they can do individual sessions.
Yeah. When you talk about the loss of a pet and the grief that's involved there, do you take your clients through the grieving process almost like if you're having counsellor as a human? Is it similar?
I kind of like to kind of share that there are no stages of grief. And it's a controversial thing, but it's getting to be more out there and well known now, because there aren't any timelines for grief, and really it's up to the individual. But the program that I kind of work with clients with, the Grief Recovery Method, which I've spoken about, is just this set amount of steps and actions that people can take. And this kind of involves reading and writing assignments, and really just helping to process the emotions that they're kind of buried down, that they've suppressed, because that's kind of something that people say, that time will heal. And I kind of hate that saying, because I really feel that it's it's not a true saying, because it's the actions that we take within the time itself can't really heal grief.
What about, I mean, and I was one of these people, that you have to put your pet down, that you have to euthanize the dog or the cat or whatever. How do you, mm-hmm. do you think people feel that extra guilt if they have to do that?
Yeah, of course, it's completely unnatural. I mean, it's taking the choice away from, you know, from our pets. Like, our pets don't have that choice, and it's something that we've never had to probably do before ever, if it's the first time. And it's just, it's so conflicting, and a lot of people need some support anticipating that as well, if it's an elderly pet or a pet that's diagnosed with a terminal illness. So I kind of help people through that, even when they're in anticipatory grief as well. And it's just, it's so unnatural, Maura. It's something that it can cause a lot of guilt, but also can be coming from a place of compassion and empathy. Yeah. You know, we have to advocate for our pets, and if it's to end suffering, you know, that's something to think about as well with euthanasia.
Yeah, it is. Anticipatory grief is actually something very new, isn't it, when it comes to grief. Donal, would you use your skills to preserve a family pet? Have you ever done that?
I have done that, and did it quite a bit before. But what I do find, I would get phone calls probably at least every 2 or 3 weeks from somebody that would have lost their dog or their cat. And they would ring me, and often they're crying on the phone. And it's especially women would be crying on the phone, because the man, you know, in a man's world, we're not allowed to cry over the grief. But what I find is they're trying to hold on to the dog or the cat. They're grieving. They're in a desperate state. And I always tell them if they could wait a couple of months, and sometimes I will take the pet off them and put it in the freezer and say, wait 3 months and come back to me and I'll do it if they want to do it. And 99 times out of 100, they don't want it done after that. But they're grieving. And I have been talking on the phone. Now, Louise would be way better than this. And I've had dogs myself that died, so I could be half an hour, and sometimes an hour, talking to these people. Sometimes they just need somebody to talk to, especially men need someone to talk to. They wouldn't, Louise might tell you that, maybe a lot of men wouldn't be ringing a grievance officer. But they'd ring me to talk about it, because I'm a taxidermist and it doesn't seem that bad. And they could be talking to me about the dog maybe for an hour or a cat. And after that, they seem much better. And sometimes they'd ring me back months later and thank me just for talking to them. They need somebody to listen to them and to understand that losing a pet is just so awful. Sometimes it's the one thing in their life that stays the same. They come home every evening to a dog or a cat, and the dog will greet you the same thing every evening. He'd wag your tail, and the dog is pure love. And when they lose that, it's such a loss. And I've lost it myself. But what I've told people, all I can do is tell them what I do. And I would have a few dogs, and I'd bury them in the garden. I'd have a little grave, a few flowers for the kids and everything. And we talk about the dog and cat, and then we might have something to eat afterwards. And some people have gone away and done that.
And maybe some people would decide to preserve their animal, as you said. Sarah Kim, what do you think of this? Because you're in studio here with me, of course. You're a food stylist, but you're an animal lover like myself as well. Would you, you know, we have two different people here, a taxidermist, and we have a grievance specialist as well. So what do you think? Would you feel that you'd go down any of these routes?
Yeah, definitely. And I've done therapy myself over years, so definitely plays a part in our lives. Would I go down the taxidermy route? Possibly not, but have been exposed to it. My granddad had pheasants when I was younger, so I think he definitely got that done before, but it's nice to just like let them go sometimes as well. And
But it is important.
Thank them for their lives.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, it as you said there, you know, really, I think the reality is, Louise, that, you know, it's only in recent times that we're dealing are accepting or being allowed to and not be embarrassed about being sad or grieving after the loss of a pet. Do you feel society has changed so much here in Ireland over the last years?
Mm-hmm, definitely. Like Donal mentioned there, it's just giving people space to feel seen and heard, to actually speak about their loss with somebody that has maybe been through it, and others that have kind of been through it and they can relate. And that's what this is all about. It's just providing that space for them, the environment. And I think it's changing more. I think it definitely is. I feel that people are getting in touch with their emotions and wanting to not bury things down and suppress pain anymore, because like you say, we go to the dentist if we have a terrible toothache or a feeling that fell out. But when it comes to emotional pain, you know, we often, what are we going to do about it? You know, years ago, we just pushed it away and just put it to the back of our mind. Time will heal. It's fine. We'll get on with life. But I think now things are different. People are starting to say mental health is important and I want to do something to feel better. I think that's what's happening now.
It's a very interesting careers, Louise Griffey, pet grief recovery specialist. You're in Cork. Donal Mulcahy, taxidermist. You're in Limerick as well. And in studio here, we have Sarah Kim Watchorn. And you know what's interesting, Sarah, and we have somebody getting in touch with us here saying they've worked with you and you have the most incredible talent. Her eye for detail is just superb. So if you're out there, you have a restaurant or a shop or you're writing a cookbook, here she is, food stylist Sarah Kim. Thank you all so much for being with us this morning. We'll take a little break, back in a few minutes.
Email oliver@rte.ie.